Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Sacco. I'm the Associate Director of the Intersections Project here at Boston College. And I just want to briefly give you a quick hello and say welcome to what we call Spark Lunch. Spark Lunch is a newer program within the Intersections Project. We have one about every 2 to 3 weeks where we bring in faculty and staff to talk about topics of interest, things that undergraduates can learn about, and we provide like what we'd like to say is a quick, efficient way to learn and eat on the run, since we're all very busy. So we were lucky enough to get Seamus Conley to agree this seasonal time of year to come share some of his vocational journey with us. And so we expanded this Spark Lunch to include faculty and staff as well. So we want to say welcome. We're really excited that you're here. We're just thrilled to have Seamus with us today. I'd like to say publicly too, real quick, a special thank you to Susan Legere and Marlon Cummings in our office who helped organize all the logistics and the computers and the emails and everything like that as well. If you've been involved in Intersections, you know that part of our basic theme is to hear one's vocational story and share our stories about where we get to in our lives and how we get to where we get to in our lives. We're very blessed to have Seamus here today. I have a few words about Seamus that I'm going to read. If you want to find out more about him, you can go to SeamusConley.com. You're going to have to carve out a good chunk of time because there's so much on his bio that I can go on and on. I'm just going to give you a couple highlights and then I'm going to be quiet and turn it right over to Seamus. Seamus Conley is one of the world's most respected master Irish traditional musicians and teachers. A native of Collogue County, Clare, he won the Irish National Fiddle Champion 10 times, a feat unmatched by any other musician. While that sounds impressive, Seamus tells me that the more difficult competition was the Fiddler of Dooney competition, which he also won, which is a national and international competition named after a poem by William Butler Yeats. More recently, Seamus was appointed the endowed artist-in-residence of the G. Craig and Maureen Sullivan Chair in Irish Music here at Boston College. In 2002, he was named the Traditional Musician of the Year by the Irish Echo, an Irish magazine. And in 1999, the Irish America magazine selected Seamus as one of their top 100 Irish Americans. Seamus has appeared on the Today Show. He's been featured on WCBB's Boston Chronicles program. And he co-hosts Irish segments for GBH's National Public Radio program, Ethnicity. He also, and I can say on a personal note, I've known Seamus for probably about 7 years now. I formerly worked in conference housing and ran a lot of the summer activities at Boston College, and Seamus for a number of years brought, which was arguably the best Irish music competition and the best Irish music school in the country to Boston College. It was called Gaelic Roots. So without further ado, I'm going to turn over to Seamus so he can share some stories with you and say welcome to Seamus.
That's what Mike told me all talk like. That, of course, was students, what was the name of that student? Anybody know? Very appropriate time of year, St. Patrick's Day. You're very welcome. I'm delighted to be here and indeed honored to be part of this wonderful program here that Mike Sacco runs, and you're so gracious to ask me to come along today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my life and my music. I grew up in a little town. I'll tell you a little bit about it. It was at the end of the River Shannon. It was the largest lake called Loch Derg, not the monastic settlement, but a large lake about 25 miles long, about 7 miles wide. It was at the end of the River Shannon, which of course is the largest river in Ireland and in the British Isles. It's about 220 miles long. So I grew up in a little town there called Killaloe in County of Clare, which is in the north, the south, the west part of the country, in the southern part of the country. Of course, all Ireland, we have north and south, as we do in every country. And but unfortunately, our country is divided, which someday we're going to win the big one. Old County Clare. O Bannock Violet of Raw, Old County Clare to you. From the roads that go from Ennis to the streets of Killaloe, where I was born. 'Tis many a day I wandered there and drove my donkey cart by rows of hawthorn hedges that were scenting all my heart. God made your face so beautiful and fashioned you so sweet. No wonder I am longing for your sod beneath my feet. No wonder I am wearying where dust and dryness be for a windy April morning on the headlands of Kilkee. O Bannock Violet abroad, to all the ways I knew, from the roads around Ennis to the streets of Killaloe. 'Tis I'll be going back there someday to see the hawthorns there and rest my weary bones with you, a good old County Clare. Ireland, as you know, is divided into counties and into provinces, and County Clare is regarded as being the home or the mecca of traditional Irish music, and I had the honour of growing up there. I was born in Killaloe in 1944. Now you know how old I am, don't you? A wonderful town on the banks of the Shannon, and a little extract from a book. In fact, the book was written by the principal of the school, at the National School. He came to Killaloe from a little place called Corrifin in County Clare in North Clare. He came to Killaloe in 1959, and a great author of many books, including a book on the Gaelic Athletic Association, which plays the Irish football and the hurling games. And Sean Kearse wrote that the town of Killaloe owes its origin to the 6th century monastic establishment of St. Lua, which first stood on a small island in the Shannon, about 1 kilometer downstream from Killaloe Bridge. Now there's a bridge in Killaloe that runs across the River Shannon, and it divides County Tipperary and Clare. And when I was a kid, I just always stand like that and say, now I'm in Clare and now I'm in Tipperary. You know the games you play when you're young, you know? I still do. The monastic centre was called Kildallua, or if you translate that into the English, it was Killaloe, the Church of St. Lua. Kill being the word for church in the Irish language. So Killaloe, that's how it got its name. And the monastery was under the patronage of the O'Brien family, a very well-known chieftain family at the time, who endowed it with extensive land. So the monastic settlement had many acres of land. And St. Flannan, he was the son of the local chieftain, Turlough. He was the monastery's first abbot there in Killaloe. So Killaloe is a famous place going back hundreds of years. There's a little place called Shan Trough, or the Old Street. Shan is the Irish word for street. street. Or, oh, and Shan Tron would be the old walking way. It's a town out of which much of the present-day town of Killaloe was built. It indicates that a street or village existed between the monastic enclosure and the palace of King Cora, which was built by the O'Briens when they moved from the lowlands up to the town, the high street in Killaloe, and they built a castle up there. And since medieval times, Killaloe has been extended to include the sites of the palace of King Cora. Now, what's the palace of King Cora? A famous man lived here, and you might have heard of him. From the 12th century, from the year 1002 to 1014, the great chieftain, Brian Boru, he reigned as the High King of Ireland from his palace at King Cora in Killaloe. So we have that distinction of saying that Brian Boru lived at Killaloe. Of course, Brian Boru was the man that drove the Danes from Ireland when they invaded Ireland. During the Battle of Clontarf, he was killed outside Dublin while he was praying in his tent. But anyway, that's where Brian Boru lived, and during the next 100 years, Killaloe was the capital of Ireland. Imagine that. Small little village called Killaloe, the capital of Ireland. Of course, that was whenever the O'Briens would assert their authority over all the rival kings, you know. So they said Killaloe was the place. The administration of the Irish Church changed from the monastic settlements to diocesan control in the 12th century. And the town of Killaloe was selected as the ecclesiastical centre for the newly formed Diocese of Killaloe. And Dolan Moore O'Brien, again one of the chieftains who was the king of Munster at the time, he erected a Romanesque cathedral on a monastic site there about the year 1180. But of course that was devastated when Killaloe was raided by some of the other chieftains from Connacht. But the present-day cathedral stands is still standing there, a beautiful old Romanesque church, which is under the authority of the Church of Ireland. Beautiful, beautiful place. And strange enough, when we were kids, the Catholic Church didn't allow you to go into Protestant churches, but we used to always sneak in. And I remember one time, you know, the bishop came into the sacristy, and we were in there as kids. We were trying to get up on the tower like you have here at Gasson Hall, and we knew there was a stairs going up, but we were hiding in the cupboard, and the bishop was inside, you know, doing these things. So it was very quiet in the cupboard for a long time. That was our first entry into the cathedral in Killaloe. But now things have changed, thanks the Lord, that there are many services organized by the Catholic Church and the Church of Ireland together. They have some wonderful concerts in the cathedral there. But that was Killaloe. You know, it still remains and still remains a very important center in the lives of the Irish people. And a little bit, one other thing. While Killaloe is now and was then a market town, certain 19th century developments enhanced the town's position. The opening of the Killaloe /Limerick Canal in 1799. It brought new prosperity to Killaloe. And the Shannon Navigation Company established its headquarters at the pierhead. It's where the boats were put in. And that's very significant now to my little story, the pierhead, where it was constructed, where there was docks and warehouses, and one would see in the 1930s cattle being shipped from Killaloe to Liverpool at the cost of 25 shillings a head. Imagine that, having a cow or a cattle for 25 shillings. Imagine what you're paying now for a pound of beef, you know. But it's a very common sight in these days to see passenger steamerships also apart from that area. And the towing of a number of barges laden with animals and merchandise of all kinds, including slate from the local quarries at Killaloe. Killaloe slate was famous for putting roofs on the houses in Ireland at Killaloe. But, of course, in common with the rest of the country, Killaloe suffered greatly from emigration during the post-famine period. The population of the town fell from 2009 in 1841 to 821 people. So that was a lot of people left the town. And over the next 70 years, the population average was 885. And that was the amount of people that I can remember that when the census were done when I was a kid growing up. It was very small knit community, very close knit community. Everybody knew one another, and it was a lovely feeling about it, you know. And it wasn't until 1981 that the population went up to 1,022. Of course, now it's so different. If you go back to Killaloe, Killaloe is not the Killaloe that I knew as a kid. There were houses growing up, everything, prosperity in Killaloe. When I was growing up there, my parents, you know, we were very poor, we didn't have much money. But my father was able to work, and I'll tell you where he did work. He worked on the boats, you know, that we talked about leaving from the pierhead in Killaloe. So that's kind of what Killaloe was like. It's very prosperous now. Again, the River Shannon and the lake is there, and I remember as a kid, Killaloe was the headquarters of the World Skiing Championships. So it was a great place to be because you had tourists coming from all over the world, skiing in their boats and jumping over the skis. I remember all of that stuff happening in Killaloe. So, as I told you, I was born in Killaloe in 1944. Seems so long ago, I kind of wonder where all the time, where it goes to, you know. And I grew up in a musical family. My mother and father were musicians, and my uncles were musicians, and my brothers were musicians. There was four of us. There was two brothers, and one sister and myself. Michael played piano, and Michael is the organist in the church today, and he runs the choir in Killaloe. He's been doing that for many, many years. A wonderful man that I'm very proud of. And my brother Martin lives in the other town, in Ennis, which became the capital of County Clare. And he makes accordions, of all things. He also teaches. And his accordions are sent all over the world. Button accordions, not the piano accordion. So he, like myself, won many of the music championships. My sister, when somebody asked her, do you play music? I do, she says, I play the radio. That's about as much as my sister played. And the radio is a new word for us. When we were growing up, the word was called wireless. So Mary always say, I play the wireless. But I can tell you about my sister. If you made one mistake or one played one wrong note, she said, ah. So you can watch if you were playing music in front of my sister, you know. My uncles played accordion and the fiddle. And there was music every night in our home when lessons were done. First thing, in fact, I didn't like doing lessons anyway. I hated studying. So the first thing I would go to would be putting on music on the old wind-up gramophone. You know, I don't know how many of you ever saw a record player with a wind-up thing in it. As I can see, my students are a little bit like this in amazement. But yes, you had to wind up the gramophone and you had to put in a needle, which was like the size of a nail, and you put that onto the stylus, it's called now, styly. Those of us who remember turntables, of course it's all MP3s and discs and everything now, you know. But that's how I learned my music, by putting on the old recordings. It was visiting musicians would come to my home, many visiting musicians, local people that would play in the house. I wasn't playing at the time. Now, around 1954, my uncle, because of, you know, not having any work in Ireland, my uncle, like my father, worked on those boats going up and down the River Shannon, bringing all the goods up and down the Shannon from the various towns, possibly from Dublin, right down to the south part of Ireland. There was no trucks at that time, back in the 50s, but they did start to arrive in the early 60s. We call them lorries. And the lorries would bring all the goods. And so the boats went out of commission, and my father was out of work again. But my father knew the Shannon, the River Shannon, so well that the government hired him to be a guide for the tourists that would come fishing during the summer months in May, when the Mayfly was out and the Dapping was on. So my father got a job again, guiding those people, the wealthy people with yachts and, you know, nice boats down the River Shannon, because they didn't know how to navigate the boats down. So that's kind of what my father ended doing. And then when he retired, when tourism really took off in Ireland, my father became, if like the skipper or the captain of a pleasure boat, they call it, an accident boat that he in fact went to London and brought over from the River Thames. Some of you might have seen pictures of the boats in the River Thames going up and down. So they brought two of those back to Killaloe, and they were a great attraction. And so the government would put on these tours, and the buses would come to Killaloe, and they would go on the River Shannon on these trips, and they would get meals and all that kind of thing, and drinks on the boat, and the music played and dancing. So that was part of the work that my father did. But he was also very much interested in the music and in collecting music, as my Uncle Paddy was. My Uncle Paddy decided to emigrate to America around 1953 or 54. And they had that night a party for him, the night before he left, what they called an American wake. Strange name, isn't it? Anybody have any idea why it was called an American wake? Well, we all know what a wake is when somebody passes away. What the American wake was associated very much with emigration. Because people would leave the homeland and go to America, and they would never come back. So the families considered them dead or gone forever, you know. But that didn't happen with my uncle. My uncle must have been back 90 times. And he came over on the ship, but he went back on the plane, you know. And he's still living in New York, and he's 93 years old. And he still plays the fiddle, you know. And, you know, he was very proud of me when he introduced me to people. And he'd get me to play, and he'd play along with me. Somebody might come to his home, and he'd say, I learned him everything he knows. So he's great. So at the American wake, they had the place that they had the party was in a big warehouse where all the bags of cement were stored and bags of beer. So they carried all those outside, all the local people, and they swept out the floor, and they put a stage up there in 1954 in that government warehouse. And that was probably the first time that I ever, I think it was in fact, the second time, I have to tell you, the second time that I did see a fiddle. And during the proceedings that night, I picked up the fiddle and of course pretended to play. I was only what, maybe 10 at the time? 9 or 10 at the time. And of course, you know, I probably had some kind of emotions and people were thinking, God, he's great, he's a great player, you know. But there was music going on, but I, you know, I was playing, but they thought it was great. And after that, I said to my parents, I wanted to get a fiddle. And so they found one for me somewhere, and I have vague memories of a neighbor finding a fiddle with no strings and no bow, no case, that had fallen down behind a dresser in the kitchen. And they pulled out the dresser and the fiddle fell down. So my parents got that ready for me, you know. And somebody tuned it up and gave it to me. And so from there I went on to tune the fiddle as I thought. I tuned it in fourths, like da 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 da, do mi so do. I thought, well, I had that in my head. I was learning tonic samba at school, do re mi fa so la. And so I thought that's how you tuned it. But of course, the international tuning for the fiddle is tuned in fifths, because you have the string itself, then you have one finger, so that's two notes, then you have a second finger, that's three notes, then you have a third finger, that's four notes, and then you have the fourth finger, which is five notes. But so I was playing for quite a while, and I thought I was doing great. So my uncle was a local barber, and he was cutting the hair one day of a man that had come in, and so they got talking about music, and the man was from near Ennis, and he had just moved to town. And so my uncle told him, oh, my nephew plays the fiddle and he's great, you know. So the man said, I want to hear him, you know, bring him down. So my uncle brought me down to hear him, and he asked me to play for him, and I'm playing away, and he's looking at me, he didn't know what was going on, because everything just seemed to be the opposite of what he would do. So he asked me for the instrument, and I gave it to him, and he couldn't play. So he tuned it as it should be tuned. And of course, when I say as it should be tuned, there are many types of tunings now in music. You go down to the Appalachian Mountains, and you can get fiddles tuned hire and different tunings for different tunes that they want to perform. But he tuned it for me as it would be the standard tuning in fifths. And so he gave it back to me then again, and what happened? I couldn't play. So I went home with my mother, and my mother was in bed, and I went up to say goodnight, and she said, how did you make out with them? And I said, I didn't. What do you mean? She said, I'm not playing correctly, I have to start again. What are you talking about? She says, you're playing great, you know? So I did have to start again. And I was worried then about how am I going to keep this thing in tune, because I didn't understand it. I had no concept of what I was even doing, except that the music was coming out. So my brother Michael, who's the organist now, he was taking piano lessons at the time. And of course, in Ireland, you had this special room called the parlor. And nobody was allowed in there, into the parlor, you know. So my mother had the key, had it locked, and you go in there to play the music, and then if people came, you'd bring them in there to visit, and you'd give them tea. But I knew the key was up overhead in the door, so I got in when she was asleep. And I opened up the piano, and I pulled the strings on the fiddle very lightly so she could hear me. And I found those notes on the piano. And so I marked them with a little dot on a pen, which is a biro, we call it. You know, we have biros here now, don't we call them biros? It's a name that they call pens. But I put little dots where those notes were, like E, A, D, and G. And so I was delighted with myself, went to bed. And then, next day, I broke one of the strings. Of course, I had to admit to my mother then that I marked the piano, you know, because she had bought this piano, and we were paying a shilling a week for it, you know. We used to call it a shilling down on the never-never system. You never have it paid for. Like putting it on a credit card, you know. There was no checks at that time when we were growing up either, you know. So you'd go into a shop, and they'd take your name. If they knew you, they'd take your name and address and all that stuff. And they'd open up this account for you, so they'd give you out a piano, maybe for a shilling. And then you'd be paying for the rest of your life, you know. But that shilling also included interest, so they were making money. But anyway, that's a different story. So I went into the room, and I had gotten a string from the man, or the strings. He said, your strings might break, they're old. So in fact, they did. So I found the notes on the piano, and then I had to tune the two strings together, and I got that sound into my head. And so that's kind of, but I went on from then, I knew how to tune it. And then, of course, I had to learn new tunes. And so again, I went back to the old record player and put them on. Of course, I couldn't play with them because they were going too fast. I had no idea. Just like us in the class, girls, you know? When we're in the class, we're playing too fast, we have to slow it down. The problem with slowing it down was that I tuned down from the speed of 78 right down to 16. So it'd go like that. So I had to tune the violin down. And that was a problem because you could barely hear the notes then. So it was like a bow and arrow. You could pull them. You know, right now they're tight. There's about, I don't know, many pound tension on the strings when they're tuned up to international pitch. But the instrument was the strings were tuned very low, so that's a totally different sound. But with doing that, I was able to almost hear orally and almost visualize what the musician on the record was doing. I could also look around like that. But I could hear it, and I could almost visualize if the bow was doing an upstroke, or if the bow was down, doing a downstroke, or if there was a few notes put together. What we call slur notes, that our musicians will know what that means. So I went on from there, and I began to play, and my father began to bring home the old records. As I said, during his travels up and down the country, he would collect many fine recordings. And he had told me about one man that had come to America around 1918. His name was Michael Coleman. And he told me these wonderful stories that he had heard of the country about Coleman, and Coleman's records found their way back into Ireland in the end of the 1950s, and he brought home a recording of Michael Coleman for me, and when I put it on, I began to cry. You know, I loved it so much. I loved what he did. I had no idea what he was doing, but I loved sound like a fiddle or a violin at all because of the recording technique at the time, of course, you know. Now, this was a new record. After a while, you could barely hear it with all the scratches in it, you know. But from there on, I slowed Michael Coleman's recordings and tried to learn Michael Coleman's technique as best that I could. And I'd like to play for you with the help of my dear colleague and a wonderful musician, a lady who runs the Irish Music Archives in the Babs Library. Please welcome Beth Sweeney at piano. So this little tune is called Bonnie Kate, and there's a little tune that comes after it, and he named after somebody by the name of Jenny, Jenny's Chickens. Kind of strange name for tunes, but anyway, this is the first tune I ever heard of Michael Coleman playing, and he had been my mentor and one of my heroes ever since. Nor did I feeling very proud that I was playing this. This was kind of a sissy thing to do, to play fiddle. And of course, when I'm practicing at home, I probably sounded so bad. My mother would say to me, why don't you go over to Granny's house and practice? My grandmother had a big room upstairs, no furniture in it, but there was a lovely echo in it. It's like singing in a bathroom with the tiles, you know. But I used to go to my grandmother's house practicing, but only at night time, when nobody could see me carrying it. And I would carry it inside my top coat or my overcoat. And I've heard other musicians saying that the great fiddle player, for whom I have great admiration, Sean Keane, that plays with the Chieftains, I heard him saying the same story, that he used to carry his fiddle inside his overcoat. And I remember well, I got my fiddle case, I'll give you an example of some of the old fiddle masters that I got to know later. When I saw them walking at the festival, they would walk like this. They'd be walking towards you, but the fiddle case was like this under their arm. It was one of those strange things with Irish musicians. Because it was sort of a rare thing to do. It was very much a folk music, it was looked down on as like bog music. It was only the poor people that played this kind of music. And strangely, that has all changed with the advent of Ireland going into the economic community. In fact, we had thought at the time that if we voted to go into Europe, that we would lose our identity, whereas in fact the opposite happened. You know, Ireland is one of the most economically advanced countries now in Europe, and in fact very expensive to live in, you know. It's more expensive to live in Ireland now than it is in the United States, you know. So good things have happened, and good things can happen for our music and for our culture. My father then, at the time, he came across an old, not an old, it was in fact really new, what was called a black box. Now you've heard of a black box, but it's in an airplane, you know. This was an electric gramophone, an electric thing that you could put on, and then you could put on the records and hear them playing, and it was a spindle where you could put on 10 of the old records. And when one was done, the needle would lift up and the next one would drop down. So that was great fun. So you got a little chance to learn all those tunes. Then you take them off and you turn them over to the other side. And then you had the long playing record that came along after that then. So he had about maybe 12 tracks just on one record, which was great. But my father, he bought the first electric gramophone that came to Limerick, and he brought it home for me. And he used to always cycle on his bicycle, even in the snow. He used to read the papers to see if any of these records came from America. So he'd cycle into Limerick maybe 15 miles in the rain and the snow, just to get the music from me. You know? And again, as I said, I would slow down the recordings. I didn't have any lessons, but I did the best that I could. And I was doing fairly well. After about 10 months, this old gentleman knocked at my door, and my mother said, may I help you? And he said, my name is Dinny O'Brien. And he said, I'm the father of the famous accordion player, Paddy O'Brien. And of course, my father had brought home these recordings of Paddy O'Brien. Paddy had emigrated to America at the same time as my uncle did, around 54. But the night before he left, Columbia Records came to his home outside Nina, and he recorded 6 tracks for them. Paddy was too nervous, too shy, he wouldn't go to Dublin, but they knew what a great player he was, so they actually came to his home. And I met him later, Paddy, and he says, can you imagine what I was feeling like the night I recorded those? He was emigrating. Never thought he'd get back to Ireland again. But he did. He came to America and stayed for 8 years and went home. But old Dinny said, I heard your son plays the fiddle. And Dinny was an old fiddle player. And he was a member of Cultus Culturi Éireann, which was an organization that was formed in 1951 to preserve and enhance the Irish music. Because Irish music was at a very low ebb after the war. People didn't want to play music. They were more interested in building up their lives and getting jobs, and they didn't have time for music. And again, as I said, it was frowned upon, that kind of music. And so an organization was formed to preserve and enhance this culture. And Mr. O'Brien said to my mom, I said, well, they're starting competitions, and the next national championship is going to be held in a few months' time. And he said, you should send your son to it. So I went there, and I played in a competition, and I won my first under 14 All-Ireland championship, which is great. And then I was lucky, I went on and I won 10 of them afterwards, including a number of senior competitions. Once you reach the age of 18, you went to a different category. So competitions were wonderful, and they are in every sphere, you know, but they're not the end and the end of everything, you know. Competition for me was all about trying to improve my playing and to meet the musicians from whom I could learn, to learn new songs and to learn new tunes. It wasn't about winning. The winning part didn't matter so much. I used to bring my tape recorder with me. Tape recorders came into vogue then. Little 3-inch reel-to-reel tapes. After that you had cassettes. But I used to bring my tape recorder with me everywhere and we'd record the competitions and I could learn new songs and new tunes and go home and learn them. So that's what competition was about for me, and about meeting people and about the friendships that I made. And that, you know, as I said, competition is one thing, but I think it's a lifelong learning experience if you make friends, which I have made and still have for over 50 years through music. And so that's very important as we go through life, not to forget our friends, keep in touch with them. And I try to do that every year through a little Christmas card or something. And people are always surprised when I do keep in touch. So I think it's a good learning thing for all of us, not to forget where we have come from, because it's a wonderful life, you know. So at that time then, somebody said we should audition for Radio Wary, which was the national radio station. So I went to Dublin and auditioned to know if I could get on the radio. And that was very difficult. They put you into a room, and the producer says, okay, when the red light comes on, play for 12 minutes non-stop, different rhythms. Okay, and so then they say, okay, thank you very much. And then you go home, back on the train again. And you never know, so you're waiting for the letter to come to know if you passed an audition or if you didn't pass an audition. And luckily I did pass, so I got an opportunity to play on the radio. And then my name became more out there into the open, winning the competitions. You got your name appeared in photographs on the paper. So it was great as a kid, you know, in one way, but also was very difficult. But that's, you know, when you reach sort of the pinnacle, if you like, in what you're doing, and you're good at what you're doing, you have to be careful that you don't let it get in the way of the real world, you know. Keep in perspective everything what you're doing, you know. Don't always feel that you're the best, because there's always somebody else that can come along and have to you. And I think the thing to remember for me was to try and be as humble as I possibly could. I think that's very important in our lives. And to treat one another as we'd like to be treated ourselves. So I kept that in mind all the time. And people used to say to me, the old people, oh, it's a great son, he says, you never got a swelled head over all this, you know. So it was a great life for me, you know. In 1960 then, Paddy O'Brien came home from America. I met with him, and I had the opportunity of learning many new of his compositions. His music, in fact, on the 78 records that he had done, had revolutionized accordion playing in Ireland. Everybody was playing accordion, but a different style. And when O'Brien's records came on, they all began to emulate Paddy O'Brien. Note for note, tried to learn everything that he could do. And then, in 1972, the Cultus Culturae that I spoke about, the organization, they decided that they want to come on a tour of America, because there were so many wonderful musicians in the United States, whom I heard playing on the radio too at the time, and but they weren't as organized musically. They needed to be recorded because, you know, they had a wonderful way of playing. Irish Americans, like our young students here who play, people like Andy McGann and Michael Coleman, who had come before, Andy McGann was a fiddler in New York who was teaching at the time. time, Paddy Brennan, some wonderful people like that. And so Coptus from Ireland decided to come out on a tour, and I was honored to have been asked on one of the very first, and in fact, the very first tour of the United States. Now, at that time in Ireland, Ireland was economically not doing so well. It was a bad time, and it wasn't so great here because there was an oil crisis around the 70s, the early 70s, and I remember cars in Ireland. I didn't have a car growing up, by the way. I didn't even have a bicycle. You know, so people would come to bring me to all of these various events. My mother would hire a taxi cab. You know, she had her money from my dad for the groceries for the week, but she always found enough to put by so we could hire a taxi to take me to wherever I needed to be for the competition. As my parents, they saw that as being very important to my well-being, to my their idea of how I should be raised and how to deal with people, the general public and all of that. And so my mother put away that money. But in 1972, Coptus came, and I came on that tour, and I loved it. I loved America, you know. The very first moment I turned into the land of sunshine, here was. In mid-October, we had Indian summer, and it was so beautiful. I come from the rain at home and the fog, and I came to Ireland and said, I love it here, you know. So we toured around America, and we went to the White House, we went everywhere, and it was so wonderful. And then, went back after 3 weeks, and during their visit to New York, they formed a chapter or a branch of Coptus Curator here, where the Americans came together and they formed a committee and blah blah blah. And you had all these championships going on, and there was a lot of teaching going on in New York and in Chicago. And so they decided, well, we're going to send some of our kids over to Ireland to compete. And so I was one of the lucky ones that they invited back in 1973 to know if I would adjudicate some of these competitions. So I went to New York and I went to Chicago. And we adjudicated all the different instruments, the flutes and the harps and the fiddles, and we sent back the Americans over to Ireland. And quite a few of the Americans went over and beat the Irish ones, you know, in competition. And that was so great for American young people. We had to go to Ireland and to win in competitions. And they're still doing it, and they're going over there, and they're very intense about the competition. They have great teaching classes in all of this, many chapters around the United States. And in fact, they have the National Conference, where is it, Beth?
Atlanta,
in a few weeks' time. Sweeney is going down to that. So there's wonderful things happening with the music in America. So I came in 94 as well, and I came in 95. Now, I was working at the time in Ireland, and the job I was working at closed down. But I had no job, I had a family to raise, and getting worried. So came out to America, met some friends of mine, and they said, you should come to America. I said, how can I get into America? You know, I can't immigrate to America. You have to have a green card and all of that stuff. So, my friend in Connecticut said, look, I'll take care of it, which they did. And they did all the paperwork for me, and there was a congressman, Cutter, at the time, living in Connecticut, and he was a great advocate of Irish culture as well. And so they did all the paperwork with the State Department, and so my family and I immigrated in 1976. And it was the best thing, I think, that I ever did in my life, to come to America. So wonderful. It wasn't always rosy either, you know, believe me. What did my friend do in Connecticut? He did all the paperwork and he said, I can teach this style of music and I can do the Kerry style, I can do the Donegal style, I can do the Cork style. And they put down on the paperwork that I was offered a job by the Greater Hartford Folk Music Society to teach. So I remember going through immigration with my family. And the guy is looking at this, what's this Donegal style? What's this Kerry style, you know? And he's standing with the George sees this. I don't know if he's talking about George Washington, but I know what he was talking about. But I came to America, and of course, there was no job at the Greater Hartford Folk Music Society. It was a way to get me in here, into the country, you know. So I lived with this family for 3 months. I had no job, and I cried many nights. I said, what did I do to my family? Bring them here. So eventually I got a job in a factory in West Hartford, filling barrels of glue. Loctite. Do you bring up the Loctite, you know, that crazy glue? So I did that, and I had to have a mask, and I just had gloves on my hands. And I couldn't understand why they handed me the gloves. You know, it was first of all, they were work gloves. I said, how can you work with gloves on? Of course, now we always do, we go in the garden and everything. But I had a mask on my face, filling these barrels of glue, and I was so sad. I said, what did I do with my wife and my children, bringing them here, you know? I think I made about $125 a week. It was just terrible. Then, a friend of mine who lives in Boston, Larry Reynolds, great friend, some of you might know Larry, a fiddle player himself. Larry was the president of the chapter of Corpses here in Boston. So he came down to Connecticut and he said, will you come to Massachusetts and teach for us? So we moved up to Massachusetts, and that was a wonderful experience. Got myself an apartment, then got myself a house. And then I finally got myself a job working in the legislature in the State House in Massachusetts for 15 years as a legislative aide, which was an amazing experience because I didn't know anything at all about politics. And I worked for a wonderful man that taught me a lot about loyalty and taught me how I should be treating people and do unto others as you would do unto you, you know, what would have them do unto you. Learn about loyalty and learn about what family life meant, and learn so many things of this man. And you've heard the name. He was the Senate president for many years. His name was William Bulger, and he was a graduate of this university here. So the Bulger name has been criticized in many spheres and many places, but this man was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I saw what he did for old people and for young people. And any time that I wanted to go to play music, he allowed me to go. And if I was going to Ireland, he'd say, here, he'd call me into his office and he'd give me some money and say, take your good family out to dinner. And so I learned wonderful things from that man. And I have to say, I'm very proud to know that family. I went down later to teach his own son how to play the fiddle. And his name was Brendan Bulger. He went to Harvard after. He's living in Chicago now. But Brendan won the championship that I had won in the fiddle 25 years before that. So the tradition moves on and passes on, you know. So that was a great experience for me. I met many wonderful people. I met kings and queens, and I met people who walked on the moon. You know, people like that, which I never would have had, you know. And then how did I land here? Again, through the grace of God, through the music, through the talent that I had, I put it to the best use that I could, but not ever thinking that I was putting it to the best use that I could. But it just so happened that it happened for me. And it's not everybody has an opportunity to do something that they love. My music is my passion. Boston College is my passion. What I'm doing here, it's all a labor of love within the music. I have some wonderful colleagues here in Beth Sweeney and many people that have made my life so easy in order to make things happen. And, you know, I have Dean Rumsford over there, you know, who was great for me when I was running Gaelic Roots. Wonderful people here, people in the development office, people here in the marketing, you know, who were the marketing programs that we did here. How did I get here? In 1990, Dr. Mihal Solovan, who's now the director of the World Music Center at Limerick, he was here as a visiting scholar in the Burns Library. And Mihal was a graduate of Cork, University College Cork, and he got his PhD, I believe, from Queen's University. But he had this idea, he himself being a wonderful musician, to run a festival, which he named, my love is in America. Because he had this idea of all of these wonderful Irish musicians who had come to America to live, and the great Irish-American musicians that were born here. So he invited 16 of the top Irish musicians, Irish top fiddle players, including people like Eileen Irish. You might have heard of Eileen, who played in Riverdance. She was the main fiddler in Riverdance. And some great names like Andy McGann that I spoke about, an Irish-American. And so we also invited those to come to Boston College. And the title of the fiddle festival was called My Love is in America. And for me, that was very strange, because that was the tune that I remember my uncle playing in 1954. And Micháló Sulban did not know this, that there was any connection at all with me. So that was very special to me when I became involved in the organization of the fiddle festival. Micháló went back to Ireland, but before he did, he approached the music department. Dr. Anne Shapiro was here at the time. She went on later to be the dean of the music school in Oregon. But they invited me to dinner and asked me if I would come to teach here, which I did. I liked the idea. I used to come over every Tuesday night from the State House, rushing over mad in under traffic, you know, trying not to be late. And eventually, I ended up being here full time. Dr. Adele Dalsamore, some of you would remember, a wonderful lady, and Kevin O'Neill, who is a historian. Both Kevin and Adele were co-directors of the Irish Studies program. And I was happened to be over at Cork University on a teaching thing in a concert program. And Dr. Kevin O'Neill was in Dublin at the time, and he had heard that I was down in Cork, and he drove down all the way, asked me, he said, if I can get you to Boston College, will you come and work for us and teach there? Because we have the Irish Studies program, but in order to complete the whole program, we have, you know, we have the history, we have the literature, we have, you know, we have the language, but we need to complete it with the dancing and the music. You know, we have art, we have all of that stuff. So it was a great opportunity. I said, sure, I'd love to do it, you know. And again, never thinking what the consequences were going to be or how I would fit into the program. But it all came together. After we all went back to Dublin, I came here. And in 1991, I created a singing festival, a Shannos, an old-time singing festival. In 1992, we commemorated the Belfast 1792 Harp Festival, where we had harpers all over this place, you know, that were playing here. And all of that stuff was all documented. It is, in fact, over in the library where Beth takes care of all that stuff. Then I wanted to broaden my vision, you know, and so I was trying to wrap my brain, you know, what did I do here? You know, I can't keep doing this thing, you know, looking to the past. I wanted to look to the future, you know, which all of us should do. We should live in today, live tomorrow, but we need to make plans for the future. Otherwise, if we don't, everything falls apart. And, you know, we have to have a plan, and we have to believe in that plan, and believe in ourselves, and not let anybody say, you can't do this. And I ran into obstacles along the way, but I didn't let it stop me. I wanted to set the horizon. So I had this idea. I was looking at the word Celtic, which was a big thing at the time, and I was looking at Gaelic, the old Gaelic languages and the Gaelic music. So I came up with the name Gaelic Roots, which I thought was very important. So we had a weekend-long event of Gaelic Roots, where we invited, again, accordion players, fiddle players, blah, 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 and that went out very well. It opened out into a week with the help of Mike Sacco and housing, and as Michael told you, we ran probably one of the most successful summer schools in America, and we modeled it on the Willie Clancy School in Midtown Malvern, in County Clare, except that we had an event, which we had the administration here behind us. We had all the wonderful people here that work here at the university behind us. Mike took care of the housing for us. We had over, 500 students and teachers living here. We're feeding them for a week, putting them up in the houses. Michael was taking care of their needs, their blankets and all of that stuff. You know. So it was a great summer school. We had lectures, we had Quebecois music, which is French-Canadian music. We had Scottish music, we had dancing, we had singing, we had film, we had the most complete Celtic program that we could find anywhere on this side of the Atlantic, or even on the other side. But devastation happened, of course, after 9/11. All of that changed. And it became very difficult to bring in instructors into the country. With the securities that were put into place, before that, before 9/11, teachers could just send their passports to various embassies with the paperwork that we would have done here from the university, inviting them with letters and all of that stuff. But that wasn't good enough. They had to visit the various embassies where they lived. We had people having to go to London. We had people having to go to Sweden. They were bringing people from over there. Sometimes a lot of the musicians in Ireland would be over playing in Europe. So they would have to go to their various Irish embassies or English embassies, whatever be the case. We had a young lady who had to fly from the Shetland Islands, which is up, you know, between Scotland and Norway, just for a 5-minute interview. They were given telephone numbers to call to make appointments. It was very difficult to get a live person on the phone. In fact, one teacher, it cost them €133 before they could get a live person on the phone. So all of these things made Gaelic roots not cost efficient, if you like. It became very, very difficult. And, you know, we ended up having to pay for all of these extra flights that we never had budgeted for. You know, somebody would come down from Glasgow in Scotland down to London for that 5-minute interview. And if you did get a live person, if somebody was on the road, I know it's getting late, and feel free if some of you have to leave, but if you did get a live person and you said, okay, I'm calling, I've been invited to Boston College to teach for the week of Gaelic Roots, can I have a date where I can go for my interview? So they say, hold on a minute, and your paper is called. And, so they come, okay, we'd like you to be here on the 6th of April. And the person would say, well, I'm sorry, I'm on the road, can I make another day that I can come again? I'm sorry, you have to come back. So there was all that kind of thing going on. So it became very difficult to get the teachers. And then, with the dollar being the way that it was, and the money that we were able to give them, you know, was certainly not as good as the euro. And so, to give you an example, if you give them $1,000 for the week, that was only like €700 for them. We might as well stay home. So it all kind of caved in on us. But to look at the brighter picture, and to look at the bad side of Gaelic Roots, meant that the week that we held the Gaelic Roots was during the summer when our own Boston College students were not here. So what we're trying to do now, we run programs throughout the academic year, concerts and events, where our own students are able to attend. And so that, for us, is better in one sense. We did help, if you like, not that Boston College needs any help for recognition. We did, in a sense, put Irish Studies program on the map here through the Gaelic Roots program. But I'm of a firm belief that it's more important that we are able to take care and educate our own students, because for me, that's the most important. You know, they come here to learn. Some of them come, a lot of them come here just because we have the Irish program here. And so I feel personally it's more important. I think the work we're doing now is more important than the original Gaelic Roots. So I won't keep you very long. I was going to play some more music for you, but you might have some questions and answers. The one thing I would tell you would be, as I say, take a fool's advice. Believe in what you're doing, and believe in education, because it's most important as you go through life. And have the faith, which is very important. Believe in your God, whoever that might be. Don't ever forget to pray. That's important for me. That was very much part of my life. And thank the Lord, my Lord, for what he has done for me. through life, you forget these things. The Holy Family, very important. You know, it might all seem a bit of nonsense when we're younger, but I learned that faith. I got that faith, and I know it's a gift from God. I got it from my mom. And when times were tough, we prayed and we said the rosary. And of course, you know, there was more giggling going on at the rosary. And my mother, okay, time for the rosary. But I have wonderful visions of growing up at home with my father kneeling up on the armchair and looking out the window, you know, saying his prayers. But if the giggling went on, you'd get a dirty look very quickly, you know. So I have great memories of saying prayers at home and saying the rosary. And I have, one time when I visited, went back home to visit my mom. I got a videotape of her. I know that she was sick at the time, but she used to get out of her sick bed every morning to go to Mass. She'd go to Mass, and I have her walking in the video. I said, I treasure that little video, you know. She'd come back then and get into bed, but it was most important that she get Mass and get Holy Communion. So, to me, you know, I wasn't always like religion. There was times when I didn't go to church either, and you know, the history of us has been going on for many times, you know, for a long time. Church, and you know, I turned myself away from all of that. I didn't see going to church as being that important, but I felt like what was in my heart was more important. You know, do good to other people, do what you can to put people on the right track. And if you see people going on the right track, be there to help them, you know. And eventually, you know, as you get older, your memories come back to you, and you see that the way that you were brought up, how important it is in life. And so I try to go to church as often as I can, but I never forget to say my prayers. And when I drive, my wife works in Philadelphia, I live in Maine. It's crazy, you know, crazy lifestyle. But when I'm driving to Philadelphia, I play my CDs, but I also play the rosary. A CD of the rosary, and it's very comforting for me. You know, for some people it might be a boring prayer, but I just love it, and it brings me closer to God. So it's important to remember that. Don't forget those things. That would be my advice to you. It's been wonderful talking to you. I just want to read a little poem for you about a man that used to come to Killaloo, and I was 4 or 5 years old. And we used to call him Murphy the Fiddler. And I just found this poem this morning in a book, and it reminded me of Murphy the Fiddler. He was a man that came around the town. He had no fiddle case, but on the scroll of the violin he had a bag, so he played his music. And people would drop in their pennies. And then he disappeared. I never know where he went to. But I used to follow him around, and he had a big black coat. I used to listen to these tunes. And one of the great tunes that he played was a little piece called The Blackbird. Wonderful tune. But this is called The Fiddler. A black hat lumped on his skull. A pipe stuck in his mouth, and his fingers fondled a fiddle, and his elbow jerked in and out. His music was mad and merry, and I danced like a circus clown. He called me away and I followed. I followed him out of Killaloo Town. The stars swam into the darkness, caught by a curving moon. The lamps met gold of the windows as I followed the fiddler's tune. And my mother peered out of the half door and wept to see me pass. I beckoned her, come on, follow the fiddler, and dance with him over the grass. My father stood by the graveyard, his eyes were bare of mirth. Yet I knew my father was sleeping in the heart of the Kerry earth. Days and nights I followed the fiddler who played for me. And he fiddled me over the land and he fiddled me over the sea. With never an hour for resting or sleep on a bed of sedge, and after a moon of marching we came to the world's edge. And there the fiddler left me. While I wept and I shouted his name. And up in the sky the stars danced on little shoes of flame. The grey gulls mewed like kittens as the curlews followed to sound. The harps of the trees were wind-fingered on the slopes of the higher ground, and the lapwing cried as it flew through the gap in the broken plough, but the fiddler was gone, and I'm lonely now. And my ears are dull from listening for his voice upon the wind, and my eyes are dim from peering, and there's madness in my mind. And I've grown grey now, waiting for him to come to me, to fiddle me over the land, and to fiddle me over the sea. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Michael for inviting me here, and I'd like to thank Elizabeth Sweeney. And if you have any questions before we leave, and if you don't, that's fine too. But I hope we give you some insight into what my little life is about. It's been a great life. It's been a wonderful road through music, and I hope I can continue to do that for many, many more years. I'd like to wish you all a very happy St. Patrick's Day, and I'd like to invite Beth again to play that wonderful tune in a more up-tempo style. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
All right, come back to